touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland, and I'm bringing you another classic episode of Tech Stuff. If you guys haven't figured this out, I am preparing for a vacation, and that means that I have to add in extra recording time. But unfortunately, getting extra time for potential co-hosts is a really challenging thing. So I've recorded a couple of, updates to old episodes. This time I wanted to talk about the U2 spy plane. You know, recently Ben Bolin joined me for an episode about the super secret space plane and what it might be up to. And that reminded me of this classic episode of Tech Stuff about the U2 spy plane. Also, I was thinking about the U2 spy plane because I still have my Negative Land episode on the brain. If you missed that episode, you should definitely check it out. It's really awesome. Noel did an amazing job producing that episode. And of course, Negative Land is the performance group that got into a little bit of legal trouble when they had a sort of spoof on a U2 song come out. But you can hear all about that in the episode about Negative Land. Oh, and I also was thinking about U2 because even though it happened months ago, it still kind of makes me chuckle that Apple essentially forced a new U2 album onto everyone who owns an iPhone, whether they wanted it or not. Obviously, that didn't pan out exactly the way they had planned. The best intentions did not lead to the best outcomes in that case, but pretty amusing. At any rate, U2's been on my mind, so it's time to talk about the actual spy plane, not the band, not the Negative Land piece. But it's an interesting story. I hope you enjoy this classic episode of Tech Stuff as Chris Paulette and I look back about where that spy plane came from and how it played such an important role in surveillance over the years.
We were going to talk today about an interesting thing that I saw.
Yeah.
The other day, which is, in a way, it's sort of a drone because it starts with the RQ-4 Global Hawk.
Yes.
A drone aircraft that is, its status is sort of in question right now. As of the time we're recording this, they're negotiating the budget for the defense budget for the United States of America.
Yeah.
That's one of the items that was considered to be struck. Now, of course, over the past few years, unmanned aerial vehicles have been coming up a lot in the news.
They've been instrumental in several of the military engagements around the world with the United States. I mean, mm-hmm, U.S. Mm-hmm. has employed unmanned aerial vehicles in lots of cases.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The proposal was that there would be $342 million budgeted to work on the Global Hawk. And as it turns out, it's been proposed that they drop the item entirely in favor of a much more less cutting edge technology,
yeah,
in a way.
And the reason, one of the reasons to talk about cutting this whole Global Hawk thing is because,
it's expensive.
Yeah. The estimated cost of a single Global Hawk is $176 million.
That's expensive.
So they had enough, they didn't even quite have enough money in the budget for two of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you could get 1 7/8 of a Global Hawk for the budget they had proposed.
Mm-hmm.
So the alternative right now for the purpose of the Global Hawk, we should say, it's a reconnaissance aircraft.
Yes, it doesn't attack people. It is there for surveillance purposes.
Yeah, specifically spying.
Yes.
So, you know, there are a lot of unmanned aerial vehicles that have been developed over the last several years. Many of them are designed to get a real-time feel of what's going on in certain environments. And they're designed to do things like fly through areas that could be combat zones. But they're not necessarily designed to spy, to be, you know, able to fly through undetected. It's more about getting as quick and accurate a picture of the situation as it exists right now, rather than let's go find out what those pesky so-and-sos over there are doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So our pesky so-and-so technology tends to be much more sneaky. It's designed to be very fast. Usually it's designed to fly very, very high so that it can try to avoid things like radar as well as missiles, you know, attempts to take it down. And it's designed to try and gather as much information as quickly as possible. And since the 1950s, that technology has been one particular type of aircraft in the United States. Even though we've tried to replace it on multiple occasions, we're still using it today, and it's what we will be using instead of the Global Hawk, the Lockheed U-2.
Yes, believe it or not, they're saying that the U-2 is actually a better piece of technology in some ways than the newer unmanned aerial vehicle.
And like I said, the replacement for the U-2 was built and was retired already, which was the SR-71 Blackbird. But we'll get into that.
Oh, I love the SR-71.
It's a gorgeous design, right?
Yep.
So the Blackbird, which was designed to be the replacement for the U-2, it actually lived out its useful life in the U.S. Air Force and then was retired because, it was really expensive to maintain as well. In fact, I'll talk about why it was expensive to maintain because that's kind of an interesting story. But to understand the U-2, we have to go back quite a bit. And we're not going to use the Wayback Machine because I found out that Stuff You Should Know used it about a week and a half ago. And apparently they left it somewhere. Actually hoofed it back from 1347, and I have no idea what they were doing back then. But so I have no idea. We have to track it down. So we're just going to have to talk about it today.
All right, then. Then you would probably go back in time, if we were using the machine.
Yes.
To August 1955 is the first day it ever flew.
Yes, August 1st, 1955. It's the first flight of the U-2. Now, the whole purpose for developing the U-2 stems out of the Cold War between the United States and the then USSR.
Yes.
Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So the whole reason for it was that we needed to have, we being the United States, because I'm from the U.S., the United States needed to have some sort of vehicle to get an idea of what was going on in a potential wartime enemy. Mm-hmm. Now, the Cold War was called the Cold War because it wasn't like there were actual physical outbreaks of violence between the two countries, but it was a true rivalry of global proportions going on between the two. And so there were needs. Each country felt the need to find out as much about what was going on in the other country as possible, and so they were developing their own ways of spying on each other.
Mm-hmm. Of course, this also figured into the space race. We've talked about the thing what beeped.
Yes, Sputnik.
Sputnik that they sent up from the Soviet Union shortly after that period. But it was around the same time they were looking for ways to spy on each other.
Yeah.
Of course, satellite technology entered into it, but the U-2 predates
satellite
that because it was already flying by that point.
Yeah. So this is during the Eisenhower administration in the United States history, and so there were several the United States government actually invited several different companies to submit proposals for a spy plane.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty typical.
Right. And the company that won out was Lockheed.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a fellow by the name of Clarence Kelly Johnson who was put in charge of the development of this spy plane. Johnson also was instrumental in creating the facility that was the testing grounds for this particular airplane. And that facility has gone on to gain incredible notoriety.
Yes, partially because it was very innovative and partially because it just has a very cool name.
And it was very, very, very secret about everything. And that cool name, at least that's the popular name for it, is Area 51.
Yes.
So if you always wondered what Area 51 was about and you've heard about things like UFOs and aliens.
UFOs.
What it really was about was a testing ground for secret aircraft. And the U-2 was very much a secret aircraft. The United States did not really talk about what the U-2 was for until they were forced to. And we'll get into that story too, because that's pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
But before we get into that, let's talk more about what the U-2 actually was. And, and in case you're just wondering, Area 51, also popularly known as Groom Lake, because it's a dry lake bed was where it was built on. And, I think in the future, we're going to have to do a podcast all about Area 51 because it was such a cool place. Mm-hmm. It's not really a thing anymore.
Yeah.
But it was definitely a neat idea, and some really cool technology was developed there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, getting back to the U2.
Yep. It's got a this sucker can fly at altitudes of more than 70,000 feet.
21,000 meters.
Yes. That's pretty high up.
Yeah.
To say the very least.
That's when you think about commercial jetliners are tend to be between 30 and 35,000 feet, sometimes a little higher. That's more than twice as high up. And it was built with a really, really long wings, almost like a glider.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a very light airframe.
Yeah,
I'm
sorry.
No, go ahead.
The wingspan of the U-2 is about 105 feet, or 32 meters or so. The length is 63 feet, or about 19.2 meters, and height 16 feet, about 4.8 meters. It only weighs 16,000 pounds, which, when you think about it, is pretty light.
That's pretty remarkable, yeah.
It's got one General Electric F-118-101 engine.
Yeah, although there were other engines used in the U-2 during its entire history. There was a J-57 turbojet engine, the mm-hmm. J-75 turbojet engine, and then the General Electric F-118 turbofan engine. They have all been used in U-2s throughout its history of its service in the United States. Before we get too much further into the technical details, one other interesting element. Originally, this was pitched to the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
The Air Force decided it did not – the Air Force decided not to fund it.
Mm-hmm.
The funding came from the CIA.
Yeah.
So the Central Intelligence Agency is actually responsible for the development of the U-2.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the pilots of those early U-2s were all CIA pilots
mm-hmm.
because the idea was that if you had a plane go down and the pilot of that plane was a member of the United States military, it could look like a military action against another country.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were a pilot for the CIA, you had to be a civilian. So you actually would go through and quit a branch of the military service. You would no mm-hmm. longer be a part of the Air Force. You would become a civilian and be employed by the CIA, and that would give you the deniability that it was a military action against another country.
Right.
Sneaky.
Well, of course. Also sneaky, if you're wondering how much these aircraft cost, they won't tell you. That information is classified.
There's actually a lot of information classified about the U-2. Like, we can't tell you specifically all the different sensors that are on board a U-2. We can tell you that it does have a camera,
mm-hmm.
Actually it has multiple cameras in order to get a visual representation of what it's flying over. It also has sensors that can detect the quality of the air and perhaps even sniff out things like chemicals that would be indicative of a nuclear facility in mm-hmm. the area.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly, it has sensors that can allow it to even eavesdrop on cell phone conversations.
Interesting.
And there's also a data link that allows it to upload information in real time to a remote location.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's got it has infrared cameras and an optical bar camera, and it does have advanced radar capabilities as well. So it's certainly able to pay a lot of attention to what's going on in the world around it, even from the altitudes that it can reach. It does have a crew of one. We know that much.
Yeah, it's designed to be a one-person aircraft. I have heard that there are a few examples of two-man U-2s, but they are specifically built for training purposes.
Mm-hmm,
they
mm-hmm.
are not – they're not actually used in service.
Mm-hmm. It can reach a speed of about 410 miles per hour. It's not, we're not talking about, breaking the speed of sound.
No.
Which is unlike the SR-71.
Yes, which that was one of the reasons why the SR-71 was developed was the government wanted something that was even faster and could fly even higher
mm-hmm.
than the U-2. And the SR-71 could do both those things. It could mm-hmm. fly at an altitude of around 90,000 feet, and it could fly very fast indeed.
Yes, which works for the X-Men.
Yes.
Sort of.
Yeah.
More
often than not.
And if you're wondering, there are about 33 of them. They are still active.
Yep.
And yeah, despite as Jonathan said earlier, despite attempts to phase them out as older, outmoded technology, they're just too good at what they do.
Yeah, well, it turns out the other stuff that was built to replace them wasn't good enough and mm-hmm. was more expensive. So while you had aircraft that could fly faster and higher, one of the big drawbacks of the Blackbird was that it did not have a data link. Mm-hmm. So when you sent a Blackbird out on a mission
in the dead of night,
you had to wait for it to come back and dump all that information for you to be able to look at it. You couldn't get updates as the mission was going on, at least not of all the data that it was collecting. You know, the pilot could communicate, presumably. Yeah. But
smartphone.
Yeah. There's an app for that.
But flying over foreign power, LOL.
Nice. ROTFL. There were some other interesting things about the U-2. It's landing gear.
Mm-hmm.
It has, you know, most aircraft that we think of today have the landing gear where there's the one set of wheels up front and then the two set of wheels in the back. So it's almost like a tricycle,
mm-hmm.
you know? U-2 does not have that. It has more like a bicycle setup. It's got the front set of wheels and back set of wheels are in line with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Now it does have wheels called pogos that are attached to the wings for takeoff.
Mm-hmm.
So to give it stability when you're taking off with a U-2. But then once you take off, you jettison those wheels. They're gone. And you only, when you're coming into land, you only have those two sets of wheels. So you're thinking, how can you maintain balance? Well, the wings have skids on them to protect the wings. It's apparently really, really hard to fly a U-2. And more so, not just because of the landing thing, although landing apparently is one of the most difficult maneuvers you can do with the U-2 because the wings are so wide, a little crosswind can very much affect the U-2. It can start gliding off track, and it's really hard to correct for that. Another issue is that it's designed to fly at a very high altitude.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at that altitude, the atmosphere is not as thick.
Yeah,
it's a thinner atmosphere. Well, in order to give precise controls at that altitude, the controls are extremely responsive
mm-hmm.
when you are flying through a very thin atmosphere. So just a tiny little adjustment by the pilot is going to result in a pretty dramatic change in the plane's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
All right? When you start going down, you start descending and the atmosphere is starting to get thicker, suddenly those controls aren't as responsive.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to do more to get the plane to do what you want it to do. So as you're descending from that height where you're actually spying and everything and you're coming down, the plane becomes less responsive and the pilot has to use a lot more force to get the plane to do what he wants it or she wants it to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is supposed to be, or supposedly, one of the most difficult aircraft to master because the two sets of flying scenarios are so different.
As if that weren't enough, because of the way the plane is configured, it's kind of hard to see out of.
Yeah.
The nose is very long.
Yep.
And it's difficult to see out the back because of the tail. So, as a matter of fact, Jonathan, I've actually seen information that suggests that many pilots call it the most difficult plane in the world to fly.
Yeah.
And it actually requires, in some instances, actually requires a second set of eyes. Somebody else will go up after the U-2 to help it get down.
Yes.
Somebody who's sort of, if you will, it's sort of a visual spotter. They go,
sometimes
you're lined up.
Sometimes it's a person in a souped up car. That's a second U-2 pilot who is being driven in a souped up car going alongside the plane as it's coming down and giving verbal directions to the pilot so that the pilot hasn't indication of how far they are from the surface and whether they need to make any adjustments.
Yeah.
So they'll be in a car traveling at a pretty good clip of speed.
Okay. See, that was my assumption because it said my notes say high performance vehicle and it didn't say what kind of vehicle it was.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a high performance car.
So, okay.
It's the Bluesmobile actually.
The Bluesmobile.
And then they just check, they have that megaphone on top and they're like, all right, here's what you gotta do. You gotta go down 2 feet. 2 feet. Anyway, there's that. And then there's also some other interesting things about the U-2. Another mm-hmm. reason why it's so hard to fly is that it has to almost always be flying near the maximum speed of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because if it starts to get down below about 19 kilometers per hour below maximum speed, which is 10 knots,
mm-hmm.
when it starts to drop below 10 knots from its maximum speed at whatever altitude it's at, it starts to stall. So in other words, there's a really narrow window of performance that the plane can operate at where it's not falling out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be going almost full speed or else it's dropping like a rock. And the pilots have a special name for that little window. You were that little narrow window of speed.
Mm-hmm.
Did you come across that?
No, I did not.
It's a charming name. It is the coffin corner.
Nice.
So yeah, it's pilots have a interesting set of terms for various things. They have a very dry and realistic view of the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So yeah, interesting design. So why? Well, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, the design has changed over the years somewhat.
Yes.
I mean, they've made some adaptations for it. It was originally based on the F-104 fighter jet, but you know, it has the version that they fly now is somewhat longer and has they've upgraded the avionics systems in the past. They didn't originally use digital systems; they were using analog gauges. But they've updated all those things now, and so it's a much more. Of course, the plane itself is based on the original design. It's just it's been adapted and updated as necessary over the years have gone by. So.
And for the first several years of the U-2's existence, the government, of course, did not admit that it had this spy plane. They said that the U-2, that, you know, people knew that the U-2 existed.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't know what it was for. And the reason given mostly was that it was a vehicle used to examine the weather patterns and weather conditions.
Mm-hmm.
It was all about gathering information about the environment, that it wasn't anything about a spy plane. Well, that all changed on May 1st, 1960.
Ah, yes. Yes.
That is when a pilot, a CIA pilot named Gary Powers, was operating a U-2 and crashed in Soviet territory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the cause of the crash has always been disputed.
Right.
Right? There are some reports that say that what happened was he was shot down. That it was hit, the plane was hit by a Soviet missile and it caused the plane to crash.
Mm-hmm.
There were other reports that said that the U-2 passed through the slipstream of another vehicle, another plane, and that it caused the U-2 to go out of control and a wing ripped off of it and it crashed because of that. There's another report that said missiles were fired at the U-2. But it exploded behind the plane, and the explosion was enough to send it out of control. What is known is that there was another pilot, a Soviet pilot, who was flying a MiG, who actually did get hit by the missiles that were meant for the U-2 plane, and died as a result. Well, Gary Powers was shot down, but he survived. However, He was used in a little bit of subterfuge on top of the subterfuge he was already a part of, because the premier of the Soviet Union, Khrushchev, didn't let the United States know that Powers survived the crash. Instead, what Khrushchev did was he said, the United States had a spy plane over my country, and we shot it down, and you got some splaining to do. Chris is banging the table with his shoe. So if you don't know what that's about, look up Khrushchev and shoe. But yes, so Khrushchev was a little perturbed.
Yes,
that
he was.
There was a spy plane over. Well, the
it
United
was an aggressive act.
Yes. Yeah. And how can you disagree with that? I mean, it was a spy plane.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, yeah. So did the United States say, yeah, okay, no? Because again, the U.S., not aware that Powers was alive, went into the cover story that they had created for this sort of scenario. Assuming that Powers had died, the Eisenhower administration said that the plane was just a weather research aircraft. It had accidentally moved into Soviet airspace. It was not meant to be there. The pilot had actually radioed that there were some problems with the equipment aboard the plane that was specifically the oxygen equipment. Because when you're flying at that height, you need to have special equipment to pressurize the cabin. And in fact, the pilots of the U-2 wear something that's almost like a spacesuit.
Yes.
Because of the, you know, otherwise you could have some real pressurization problems. So they said, no, 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 it's just a weather aircraft. There were some problems that we heard about. They were supposed to be over Turkey. It was completely just a misunderstanding. And that that the plane that was shot down is probably the weather plane. It's definitely not a spy plane. Yeah. And then Khrushchev said, the pilot's alive. And we recovered all the information aboard the plane. It was actually in good condition. So we know exactly what you were looking for. Mm-hmm. And we know exactly what the purpose of this vehicle was. And you are a big fibbing fibber.
Yes. They said that he was okay in Moscow. And he had said they said that he told them that he had taken off from Peshawar in Pakistan. And he was told to fly over the Soviet Union, basically over the Aral Sea, over Sverdlovsk, Kirov, Arkhangelsk, and Murmansk to the Bodø military airfield in Norway.
Yeah.
And so he told them. They said he told them the exact route he was supposed to fly. And of course, you know, the United States after that was still saying, well, that really wasn't what was going on there.
Yeah.
But, and it was just very hard to deny when they had so much evidence.
And there was a supposed to be a summit that was going to be going on, like, I think a week or two after this happened.
Yes.
And it caused quite a stir in international politics.
It was
considered to be a very huge, humiliating embarrassment for the United States. And
Khrushchev demanded that the United States stop flying over the Soviet Union, or, you know, they'd leave.
Yeah.
Do I need to take my shoe off again?
No.
I put it back on.
No. And ultimately, the international community ended up siding more with the United States than with the Soviet Union. Other outcomes of this, Powers was tried and convicted in the Soviet Union.
In August that year.
He was sentenced to several years of prison, followed by, I think, 7 years of hard labor. But he ended up getting released as part of an exchange, a prisoner exchange.
Yes, for Rudolf Abel.
Yeah, and that took place. All right, kids, you might not know this, but when I was a kid, there were two Germanys. There was an East Germany and there was a West Germany.
No.
And the exchange actually took place on a bridge between the borders of East Berlin and West Berlin. And it was a very famous event. So now there's no longer an East Germany and a West Germany, but back when I was a kid, there was. And this is what, you know, this took place at that location, because there was a Soviet-controlled part and there was the German-controlled part. All that is in the past now. Ask your parents about the Berlin Wall, kids.
Well, there were no really – I don't recall any other major famous incidents in which a U-2 was involved.
There was the Zeuropa tour.
The Zeuropa tour. Yes.
I was wondering how long I could go without making a U-2 joke, and the answer was 27 minutes.
But ironically enough, I find – NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, has used the ER-2, which is basically a modified U-2, to collect information on on space phenomena and on the Earth itself. So, yes, in fact, it does make a pretty good weather and observation plane for other purposes than just spying.
Yeah, but it's still being used as a spy plane.
Oh, yeah.
According to
– I just thought it was kind of funny that the denials and then, you know, as it turns out, you can use it for that.
So I found out some more information about I was going to say – talk about the Blackbird and about how it was supposed to be. That was also developed at Area 51. It was originally called the A-12. That was its designation. Then eventually was known as the SR-71 Blackbird. It was the successor to the U-2, but was retired. it had a useful life of between 1964 and 1998. 1998 was when it was retired for the second time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of like a professional wrestler. You know, retires and then comes back and then retires again. But in this case, only retired the two times. And there's no real way of making more of them because they destroyed the tooling machinery back in the 60s. Mm-hmm. When they built the Blackbird. The idea being that they didn't want it to fall into any other hands, and so this was a way of maintaining secrecy. The downside of that is that once you run out of Blackbirds, you don't have any more of them. There's no way to make more. And so they actually had a lot of issues with that. And there were several Blackbirds that were involved in various accidents and mm-hmm. incidents that made them either were destroyed as a result or they were inoperable.
Mm-hmm.
So they now all exist pretty much in museums.
Mm-hmm.
I think there might be one or two that belong to NASA, actually. But there aren't any that are being used in military service. So the Air Force has stopped using the Blackbird. Well, you know, that was supposed to be the successor to the U-2. But they, again, stopped being used in 98. The U-2 kept going. Since 1994, according to the Air Force, about $1.7 billion, with a B, dollars have been poured into the U-2 program to keep it up to date,
mm-hmm.
to modernize it, make sure that it's, you know, operating at a level that modern warfare and modern politics demands, because, you know, we've gotten a lot more sophisticated with the ways that we detect stuff. So in order to stay ahead, a lot more money had to be poured into it.
Mm-hmm.
And according to one source I saw, since 2003, the Air Force has flown more than 95,000 hours using the U-2. But keep in mind, there are only 33 of these things.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty impressive.
Yep, yep. Well, the in case you're wondering, the RQ-4 may not be off the table. It is presumed that Northrop Grumman, the company that makes – well, the primary company that makes it, will – try to get it put back into the budget.
And it may just be that it's a delay more than anything else. In fact, most of the sources I saw was that it's that the date keeps getting pushed back. Like originally the U-2 was supposed to be retired by 2012.
Yeah.
Now it is 2012.
The most recent date I saw was 2015.
Yeah. And then I saw one that said it may be flying as late as 2050, which means it would be 100 years old almost.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and it takes three people to fly an RQ-4. You know, you have to have an LRE pilot, an MCE pilot, and a sensor operator. And it only flies up to 60,000 feet, which is about 18,288 meters. It has a maximum speed of 357 miles per hour, about 310 knots. So, you know, it's comparable in some ways, but in others, you know, the U-2 still outdoes it. So,
yep.
It's impressive stuff. But it's kind of funny to me that the tried and true U-2 is still hanging in there,
you know,
despite all these other things that could replace it.
Yeah, and part of that is the qualities of the U-2, and part of that is purely economical.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Just that, you know, there's just not the money to replace it. And that, you know, we do have a need for reconnaissance vehicles. And you might ask, well, why do we need that? Because we've got satellites now, right?
True.
We've got satellites that can spy on stuff. And that's true. We do have satellites. But satellites are not – yeah, stuff that beeps. Satellites are not capable of focusing in on a very specific region at a reasonable amount of time in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be that you've got a great view of this one region.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that the issue that you need to look at is just outside of that view. And in order to change the view on the satellite, it's going to take hours.
Yeah.
Whereas you could send a U-2 plane stationed in a nearby country to fly over and get a look right then and there.
Yeah.
And the way the world works, we need information instantly. We can't wait anymore. Mm-hmm. So –
yeah, for instance, they might have intelligence that a specific operation is going on right now, and they're going to hide whatever it is that they're moving, you know, some kind of weapons technology or some, you know, something like that, or a caravan of people or something. You know, it could be a variety of things that you'd want to see. And then by the time the Earth rotates back to where the satellite could take a good picture of it, it'll be too late.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing.
Yep, yep. Spy stuff is cool
yeah.
and scary.
Yes, it is. But yeah. And it did play a major part in the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes, it
in
did.
The 1960s,
yes, it
was
did.
Able to get a good picture of what was going on there between the Soviets and the Cubans.
Yep. Do you and you know we didn't mention it, but do you know what the nickname is for the U2?
Oh, I did see it a moment ago, and then I scrolled past it in my notes.
I'm surprised I didn't mention it already. It is the Dragon Lady.
Yes. You don't hear it mentioned. The U2 is well known enough by its normal designation that you don't really hear the nickname very often, like you do with the SR-71 Blackbird.
Yeah.
For example.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a cool name.
Cool name. All right. Well, this wraps up this discussion about the U2. Like I said, we'll try and do one about Area 51 specifically at some point. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about the other vehicles and technologies that came out of that research facility. And also talk about why it was so secret and, the whole craziness that surrounds Area 51 and how it plays a part in conspiracy theories because, you know.
It does?
You might not have heard about it. You need to watch this documentary series called The X-Files. It goes all into it. All right. And that was our classic Tech Stuff episode on the U2 spy plane. We've talked about it several other times, obviously, when we talked about Area 51 and some of the other surveillance and spy technology podcasts, but I really enjoyed that original episode. I hope you guys did too. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, you can write to me. My email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com or drop me a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Tumblr. The handle at all three of those is techstuffhsw, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.